You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 197 of the Earth Station DCU! Tonight we're going to talk Aquaman number 61, Batman The Adventures Continue number 7, Catwoman number 23, Dark Knights, Death Metal number 2, Justice League number 49, Nightwing number 72, Strange Adventures number 3, Jimmy Olsen number 12, Stargirl season 1 episode 8, Shiv part 2, and Doom Patrol season 2 episode 4, Sex Patrol. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, coming up first for DC news. DC might have snuck a brand new Shazam title into this week's digital first releases. Shazam Lightning Strikes will debut July 17th with Home Quest, a story from writer Dan Jurgens and artist Travis Moore and Nick Filardi. Home Quest centers on Billy Batson and one of his classmates encountering a spirit from ancient Egypt, home of Shazam's rival, Black Adam.
Yeah, I saw the news on this. I mean, I'm excited at the possibility of another Shazam book. Jurgens is, I mean, like, he created my dude Booster Gold, which is great, but I don't know.
Jurgens has his ups and downs, so the only way I can tell on his stuff is just to read it and make my decision from there.
I couldn't agree with you more there, because there's some, like I said, I mean, like, he made Booster Gold and there's a lot of Booster stuff that he does that's pretty good, but then there's some other stuff that he's read that I've really not, like, I've gone in expecting to like it because I've liked other things and it's just not been particularly good. So we'll see. Obviously, like I said, I was overall excited to see the news because I was, as we've talked about, pretty disappointed with ultimately how the Shazam run turned out. So hopefully this one will be good.
Hope so. All right, up next in DC news, Wonder Woman 1984 comic book companion is on sale this fall. Wonder Woman 1984 number 1 is a 32-page one-shot as a direct tie-in to the film, co-written by its associate producer Anna Aprobta and comic book veteran Louise Simonson, with art by Brett Blevins. It is scheduled for release in September, exclusively at Walmart, and then coming to comic book stores and digital platforms 9 days later. So they're doing a tie-in to the movie. Yeah, not surprising.
I mean, that's pretty standard, I mean, really, for both companies. I mean, I don't know. It might have some good stories in it. Usually those are pretty missable, if I'm being completely honest.
You can get no argument with me on that one. All right, coming up in other DC news, Rorschach from Watchmen returns in a new 12-issue miniseries written by Tom King and illustrated by Jorge Fornes. Set 35 years after the end of the original Watchmen, Rorschach appears as part of a pair of assassins trying to kill the first candidate to oppose President Robert Redford in decades. We follow one determined detective as he walks backward in time, uncovering the identities and motives of the would-be killers, taking him into a dark conspiracy of alien invasions, disgraced do-gooders, mystical visions, and comic books.
One of the things that is really intriguing with this series is that they're also using Redford, which is what the TV series did. I don't recall that ever being something that was mentioned. Obviously, Nixon was president in the comic. I don't remember them ever referencing that Redford would be president, right?
Yeah, I don't remember that either.
I will admit it's possible that there's something in there that I've forgotten or never noticed. But the TV show, for sure, Robert Redford is like basically the long-term president replacement for Nixon. And it makes me wonder if maybe they're going to be tied to each other. You know what I mean?
That's a possibility.
I don't think it's a – now, again, this is predicated on the comic never stipulating that Redford would go on to be president, which I really don't think it did. And, again, I really want to admit that I could be very wrong about that. But assuming that that's the case, that's too big of a coincidence for both the show and the comic to be using that. So I'm really intrigued because the show, as I've mentioned a couple times, is really good. I cannot recommend it enough. And if the comic kind of ties into that same post-comic world that the TV show went with, pretty interesting, I think.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that does tie in. All right, up next for DC News, writer Kevin Schnick and artist Clayton Henry are taking over the Flash comic with October 13th, number 763. The secret history of Barry Allen's Flash ring is revealed as the Scarlet Speedster tangles with the Trickster, in a tale that starts out as fun and games, but it ends with a last page cliffhanger no reader will see coming. I always liked those. No reader will see coming.
I'm excited to see a new creative team on it. Obviously, I inherently enjoy The Flash, so I would like to see something good. Not that all of Williamson's stuff was bad, but just overall was not the biggest fan, clearly. So, yeah, I don't know. It can't. Their version of the Trickster can't be worse than the weird hulked out version one that we got.
That's true.
Can safely say that that is probably not a version that's going to linger into the future.
So, yeah, I'm planning on starting to pick Flash back up and reviewing this new team, see how we like them in the fall time. So, kind of excited about that. It's been a while since we've reviewed Flash.
Yeah, that's one of the things that can be both. It's a double-edged sword with comics where if you have a good creative team, at least for your personal tastes, it sucks when they leave. But if there's a creative team on a character that you like and you get it and they leave and there's a different one comes on, it can potentially be a good thing. Like for me, that was a big time when I was waiting for Green Lantern to maybe get back into, was sort of waiting for Venditti to get off the book, which didn't happen for a long time. But it's just one of those things, like, it can be a good thing and a bad thing, but it just all kind of depends on your opinion of the current team on the book.
Yes, exactly. All right. In other DC news, Batgirl, Batman the Outsiders, and Justice League Odyssey are all ending in October. Well, we knew Justice League Odyssey was ending it. We could just tell.
I honestly am so impressed that it's making it all the way to October. Like, some of the books that it survived past, it's incredible. It really had to have been that they're trying to finish. There must be something status quo-wise in the story that they need to finish it. You know what I mean?
Because
otherwise, it's got all the telltale things of a book that's going to get canceled. There's nothing important, relatively speaking, happening in it. I can't imagine, is one of those, like, far-reaching popular stories where even though it's, something obscure, it's something cool enough is going on that people are reading it. Like, everything about it screamed it's going to get canceled, and it just kept chugging along. So, good for it. The Batgirl one, I'm kind of curious with, especially based on the end of the book that we're going to review today with Nightwing. I'm wondering if something's going to end up spinning out of the Joker War.
I know. I'm wondering the same thing, too. Because it felt odd that Batgirl was ending. So.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll get into that more when we review Nightwing. But I have...
Yeah.
To tease our listeners a little bit, I have some potential thoughts on if they go down that road with Batgirl.
All right. Coming up next in DC News, the Caped Crusader is getting a new costume this October. At least he is, according to series artist Jorge Jimenez, for his variant cover for Batman 100, revealed in a retailer mailer from the publisher. Have you seen his new costume yet?
I mean, yeah, I struggle to consider Batman suits that, like, it is always reported by everybody as big news, right?
But, like, yes.
is it, it's like announcing that the earth is round or the sky is blue. You know what I mean? I can't think of a hero that gets a new costume version more frequently than Batman. It's an inherent part of his character.
Yes, it is. And it always changes, and then it always goes back to some version of the original. I've seen the picture of it. It looks pretty cool to me. And I'm not. It doesn't bother me that they're changing costumes on him, because I know eventually it'll go back to something, some version that's near the original. So
I'm not going to lie. It didn't look like an actual costume change, if that makes sense. It looked like I'm wearing a specialized suit for a specific occasion suit.
Yeah, like one that's for Mr. Freeze or something.
Yeah, that's just me. And I could be wrong, but it didn't look like a redesign, so to speak, as more of like a specialized suit. And that's the thing. That's one of the part of the things that always sort of like I find silly when because they always pop up. You always see these articles like Batman's got a new suit. And like, honestly, half the time they're just like, he's wearing a robot suit for a specific mission that you'll never see again. It's like, that's just Batman. It's like reporting that Superman's going to fly in the next issue. So I don't know. I could be wrong, and they may. I would be surprised. That does not look like a status quo costume to me.
All right, and coming up for our last bit of DC news, Black Adam movie casts Noah Centineo as DC superhero Adam Smasher.
I feel like maybe we had seen some other news that suggested they were going to go down this route, but this definitely confirms that we're going to be seeing it's going to be at least partly inspired by the early 2000s JSA era Black Adam that was part of Geoff Johns's run.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I think am I wrong? I feel like we heard something that maybe characters like Hawkman and Hawkgirl were going to be in it too.
I hadn't heard anything like that, but I'm glad they're just moving forward with this Black Adam movie, because it's been in pre-production forever.
Oh, God, tell me about it. He's been cast as Black Adam since, I think, close to Man of Steel, if not before that. I mean, like, he has been Black Adam, in theory, on paper, for a long time. Anyway, going back to this, Adam Smasher is cool because I think we did see him in Legends, sort of, when they were still having that identity crisis of what kind of show they were going to be.
Right.
So it'll be cool to see probably a more accurate, faithful version of the character. And then I'm just excited because I'm pretty sure that that's the era of Black Adam. I mean, obviously, that's if we're talking like his golden age in terms of stories, that's it right there. I mean, he was at his peak in popularity during those. So it kind of makes sense to pull from those stories.
It sure does. All right. Well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
You have 30 seconds to describe Thunder Talk.
It's pop culture.
With a twist.
It's music.
LGBTQ+.
And comedy.
Well, dark comedy.
It's nerd junk.
It's comic books.
Video games.
Conventions.
Yeah, nerd junk.
And social commentary.
It's woke, yo.
Yeah, and nerd junk.
Woke nerd junk.
Thunder Talk is all over the place.
Every place you want to be.
Thunder Talk is a proud member of the ESO Network. Find us at thundertalk.org and download us on all podcast platforms.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic book talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. For you.
All right, let's talk Aquaman number 61. So the issue opens up with Ocean Master readying his army, and whatever his plan is, Ocean Master is ready to act on it today at the wedding. We see the Seven Kingdoms come to Atlantis to witness the marriage of Queen Mera and Regent Volko. We see that Mera appoints Dr. Thanita, Minister of Health. When the Widowhood objects, Mera has them arrested. We see that Mera goes out to address the crowd, and Ocean Master is in the middle of a speech stating he wants to stop a weak man from making a power grab while the Queen's in a coma. And Ocean Master is very surprised to see Mira's not in a coma.
I found that part interesting because I don't think either of us expected that to be part of his plan, right? I just kind of assumed it was going to just be a straightforward military assault.
Yeah, and it wasn't. It's like he was trying to gain the favor of the people or something.
I found it pretty clever, to be honest with you. It was, you know what I mean? Like, obviously it was foiled because, of course.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've really enjoyed the way that this creative team has crafted Ocean Master's plot because it's not just like, you know, mustache twirling evil. Like, it's pretty clever. And there's a lot of, I don't know. He has some good points also.
Yes. So Mira makes her own speech, letting everyone know her engagement to Volko was an evasion, a plot to maintain autonomy and cement the widowhood's approval. Mira states that when she does marry, it'll be to her equal. Then Ocean Master interrupts her, stating that he accepts. And Mira tells Ocean Master to stop joking and then proceeds to tell the crowd that the monarchies must be dissolved. And we see the leaders of the kingdoms freak out. And then Ocean Master attacks then. Now the issue ends with Aquaman and Tula coming out of hiding to confront Ocean Master. And
I really, really enjoyed this issue. I don't know about you. It felt very like cinematic to me.
I thought it was pretty good too. And I do like the way they've been portraying Ocean Master also. And I like it because it's the slow burn and it's just not the, like you said, the mustache twirling. So he's been playing it smart. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with this because ultimately something is going to change. And that's when stories usually get good, is when the status quo changes.
Well, and I think what was really interesting with this too is we're getting really into like Atlantean society and like, almost like Game of Thrones-esque like power plays and stuff like that. And I feel like those sorts of stories are, I don't know, they just, to me personally, they're inherently more interesting. And it kind of, I hope we continue to get more of this for a while, because I do feel like some of the better Aquaman stories in general, like Johns's run during the New 52, are stuff where they explore more of that, like, I find the where they explore the Atlantean world and the society more interesting than when it's just like Aquaman up on the surface doing Aquaman things. Not that that isn't fun. Not that we haven't gotten some good stories from that. But like, I don't know. There's just so much untapped potential with that and so many different things you can do.
I agree with you because, first of all, we're not getting the same old, same old. And it's interesting to take a closer look at their culture. They've obviously got advanced technology. I like to see, you know, see some of that used a little more. And it's just interesting. And I hope they stay focused on that kind of stuff. And we're just not getting the same old superhero stories.
And I think one of the other, like you said, not doing the same old, I think it's one of the reasons it is interesting is because you're like discovering this world and you're kind of learning about, you know what I mean? Like, it's not just, because like, if it's just Aquaman fighting Ocean Master, not that that can't be a good story, but like, ultimately, you know where that's going to go, right?
Right.
You know what I mean? But so when you kind of focus more on like, I don't know, on the world and stuff, it's just, I don't know. There was a lot, the intrigue in this was so much better for me. Not that nothing major action wise really happened in this, but it was just, I've really enjoyed this issue.
I have too. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Batman, The Adventure Continues, number 7. So the issue opens up with Batman chasing Catwoman across the rooftops. Azrael shows up and takes Catwoman captive. Batman intervenes and Azrael escapes. Batman finds out from Catwoman that she stole a shawl from the Order of St. Dumas for Penguin. Again, we see Batman's mysterious stalker watching through binoculars. Still think this is Jason Todd. And what his motive is remains to be seen, because I'm wondering, is he going to be a good guy or is he going to be a bad guy? Now, Catwoman is arrested, and Batman gets a call from Alfred stating that he has a visitor at the mansion. And when Batman returns home, we learn that Batman and Azrael train together. Azrael tells Batman about the magical shawl, and for whatever reason, Batman decides to upgrade Azrael's costume so he looks more like an ally than an enemy. I thought that was weird, but so he ends up with the what I call the Azbat suit from the Nightfall. Now, Batman and Azrael go to the Ice Lounge to find Penguin, and he sold the shawl to someone else. Then, right at the end of the issue, Penguin sicks this big, large monster bird on Batman and Azrael.
I gotta agree with you. The suit thing was weird because it seemed like it was an excuse to, like you said, reference a different suit. But it was like, then why not just give him that suit?
Yeah.
It's not like we had seen him before. There's no rule dictating that he couldn't have just shown up in that one. I don't know. I mean, whatever. I'm getting a little bit to the point where I kind of wanted to just tell the damn story already with whatever we assume is Jason Todd. It's like at a certain point, it's just like I kind of get sick of just seeing him up on the rooftop with binoculars. Like, how many times do we have to see that?
Yeah, I know. It's getting frustrated, but I think they're planning on revealing that later on.
But at a certain point, it's too late. Like, you got to just do those scenes have lost any meaning to me. Anytime you like, they suddenly cut away to him on the rooftop, I know that I'm wasting a page or two of a comic, which I've mentioned before, is way too brief on average for a single issue. We're consistently wasting space doing nothing. Like, we've established that we assume is Jason Todd up on the rooftops. Okay, that's established. Either do something with it or just leave it alone. So I don't know. I think it would bother me less if there was more going on in each issue, but these issues are so short, relatively speaking, like they just fly by, which is fine. Like, you know what I mean? But like, even this one, it's so quick to me. These read so quickly, and yet we still spent time looking at Jason Todd on the roof. What did that serve to this story? Nothing.
No, it didn't, but
the rest of the story, I mean, I enjoyed. I liked it was brief, as with everything with this series, but the sort of conflict with Batman and Catwoman being like, I'll help you, but you got to leave her out of it sort of thing. That was an interesting plot that I wish we would have gotten into depth more with. But yeah, like I said, I've liked most of these stories, but I kind of just want them to get to the point with it.
Yeah, I understand what you mean, but I think they're dragging it out towards the end of the series, is my opinion.
And do we know, is this a miniseries? I feel like I've asked this before, but
it's limited. It's not an ongoing.
Okay, it is a limited series.
Yeah.
See, that makes me feel, I don't know, I feel like it's going to end up being a weird ending where we've had all of these like self-contained stories, which on their own are all pretty entertaining. And then right at the end, it's like, and it was all a Jason Todd story. Like, but it wasn't, though.
You know, no, it wasn't.
I can't help but feel like we're going to get an ending that's going to make it feel like we read one cohesive story when we absolutely have not been reading that.
Right.
Because it's sort of like, what was the – God, there was – was it a show or was it a comic that we read where it basically – it was the Lois Lane one.
Yeah.
That basically the conclusion tried to tell us that we had just read a story that we hadn't read. So I don't know. I can't help but feel like maybe we're heading towards that kind of ending with this. Not that I'm sure based on the quality of these short stories, I'm sure whatever the reveal with it will be pretty entertaining. But I can't help but feel like it's going to be trying to convince us that we read a bigger plot than we actually did.
So that's possible. Because it's basically a bunch of story arcs strung together. So,
which is fine. I almost wish it would just lean into that more. I think I would probably, it would just be like, I kind of would be okay if it was just a unconnected short story, which is what it's been. They've definitely been unconnected stories for the most part. Obviously we saw the Lex hangover a little bit, but even that was weird because they threw that in and it made you think that they were connected. And then it kind of weren't.
I don't know. I think Lex will be connected to it in the end somehow.
I'm sure.
That's what it feels like to me.
I agree. It just, I don't know. I keep going back and forth on the series in terms of, like, sometimes it looks like they're being clever with something, and then it's just like, nah, not really.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Catwoman number 23. In this issue, we see Catwoman goes to Isla Nevada on business. What business this is remains to be seen because Catwoman is very tight-lipped about it. Now, Catwoman comes across an old acquaintance named Snowflame that seems to be a drug dealer. He's having an auction that includes a large diamond, the talisman of Arok the Magnificent, a small statue of a gorilla from Gorilla City, a vial of water from the Lazarus Pit, the famous codpiece cannon, I know, a decoy white lantern ring, and the list, which is supposed to be a list on the bad guys, from what I understood from the comic. Now, Selina also runs into another acquaintance named Tambra Quartz, who seems to be a scam artist and a social media star. And she's here to buy the diamond. Now, Snowflame is doing an announcement about his auction when he's interrupted with an emergency. And we see Catwoman goes to check it out and find Snowflame's men hunting down a giant cat that looks like a gigantic panther. Catwoman defends the cat, but once she takes out Snowflame's men, the panther kind of turns on her, and the woman she met on the airplane throws a spear at her, and it seems to be laced with a drug.
Okay, just to clarify, it's not the woman on the airplane. It's the girl who tried to pickpocket her getting off of the airplane.
Oh, okay. Well, I miswrote this down then when I did my notes, or I was confused.
That's just, I feel like it's important because the woman on the plane is definitely a resident of the island, but it is not that girl.
Okay, I was a little confused by that because it didn't feel like the same tone as when she was on the plane.
It would make no sense. Yeah.
Okay, so it's the one that tried to pickpocket her. I guess that makes sense. I was disappointed when I started reading this and it wasn't in Gotham and it didn't include Batman and stuff, but when I start getting into the story, it is an interesting story, and I'm interested to see where it goes. I'm just a little disappointed we're not getting more Catwoman-Batman team-up. And it could be, like we talked about recently, the editorial team's trying to get away from that. I don't know. But that's what I want to see more of.
Yeah, I know. I think I'm sure part of it is probably based on they want to make sure that Catwoman is the main character of her own story, which I agree with that. But I do like it is possible to write a story with Batman and have him not be the main character.
I agree with you.
I know it's hard for some writers to wrap their head around that concept, but it's really not that you shouldn't be that difficult.
Yeah, it's not that hard to make him a background character because you just have Catwoman interact with him briefly and then move on.
I want to be clear, like Catwoman absolutely should be the main character of her own book, but like you, I would be more interested in seeing, like we get, especially during King's Run, obviously we get a lot of Batman, you know, in his book with Catwoman sort of being a supporting character. It would be just as interesting to me to see it. And I thought King did this occasionally. He did some issues where we got that. I would love to see, like, you know, this run be about Catwoman and getting it more from her perspective and maybe, like, her doing her own. Like, we see, like, sometimes we see if she just kind of, like, pops into a Batman story. Like, what would it be like where we see her pop into a Batman story? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I don't know how to describe it. Like she's doing something else, and then she basically wanders into what is effectively a Batman story that she's jumping into the middle of. Like I don't know, that would be kind of interesting to read.
Yeah, it would be.
Going back to this issue itself, pulling the Snowflame character back in was a hilarious choice. I have to really credit the creative team there. What a great character! I found. I thought the comic was getting a little too cute with this, especially I feel like we keep reading this story where Catwoman shows up somewhere and it looks like she's up to one thing, but she's really up to something else. Like, haven't we, I feel like we've read that story multiple times. Like, just can you tell us, the audience, what she's up to? Like, fine, the readers, the characters in the story don't need to, but like, what's she doing there? We don't know. I didn't find that so much intriguing as more like frustrated that the writer was withholding important information, because it felt like it was important to understand the purpose of the story. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I was a little frustrated too with why she was there, but
I think there can be a fine line as a writer with withholding information from the audience to kind of build up the mystery, and then just not, you know what I mean, not including enough information to keep the reader invested, because interesting stuff happened. This, like I said, I was a big fan of reusing the Snowflame character and things like that, but like, what's the point of the story? Is it about this Panther Girl? I don't think so. Seems pretty clear that's not why she was going down there. So why was she going? Like, you know, I feel like we need to know something. I think it doesn't need to tell us everything, but I think he needed to give us something.
Yeah, I agree with you, though. I am interested in seeing where the story's going, so. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Dark Knight's Death Metal number 2. So the issue opens up with Batum getting squished.
That was pretty funny. It was a pretty funny scene.
It was funny. So we see Wonder Woman, Wally West, and Swamp Thing have taken the Batmo Beast to a cemetery outside of what used to be Washington, D.C. Wonder Woman takes them to a secret entrance to the Crypt of Heroes, where we find the entrance being guarded by a very old-looking Justice Society. Batman and Jonah Hex are inside searching for dead heroes for Batman to resurrect with his Black Power Ring. But a new plan is formed by Wonder Woman, who wants to go to New Apocalypse and free their friends. Now, last issue, we saw Wonder Woman kill the Batman Who Laughs. And this issue, Alfred is putting his brain into a Dr. Manhattan Bruce Wayne body. This version of the Batman Who Laughs is very powerful. He destroys the other evil Batman around him and picks one of the evil Robins to be his Robin King. And we see the Batman Who Laughs decides he is going to make his own multiverse, 52 Earths of Nightmare. And then we see the Batman Who Laughs transform himself into the Darkest Night, which was a shadow-looking thing.
So much of this book has definitely got a lot of tongue-in-cheek stuff going on. And I'm kind of hoping that he's doing that with the Darkest Night thing, because that I already was not a huge fan of the Batman Who Laughs, because it's just like the most try-hard version of the Joker I could think of. You know what I mean? But then he manages to top it with this, because it's just so ridiculous. And part of me thinks and assumes, based on everything else that we're seeing, it, that that's sort of the point, that it's just this absurdly over-the-top, unnecessarily hardcore Batman. But I don't know for sure that it, you know what I mean? Like, I couldn't tell for sure how tongue-in-cheek that evil Batman was, because I know when I read that, my eyes rolled, man. I was like, come on. This is so dumb. But it's also a comic where a corrupted, evil Adam gets run over by a monster truck. So, like, you know what I mean? It's one of those things, like, I can't tell. I don't know if, like, that's in on – I don't know what's in on the joke and what's not. Is the whole thing in on the joke? I don't know.
I don't know. And we're just going to have to read more to see where the story goes. Because
that's sort of the thing. Like, if it maintains that sort of – you know, kind of, look, we're going to tell this really, quote, hardcore story, but it's pretty intentionally ridiculous, I'm all in on that. But if it starts to go in like a, this is a serious story, and you've got something called The Darkest Night, like, I can't take you seriously. You know what I mean? You can't do both.
All right. Well, we'll have to see where that goes. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Justice League 49. So the issue opens up right after the explosion. Green Lantern is unable to contain it, but he is able to protect the people. Superman accepts their offer to rule over them, but Wonder Woman walks away. The Justice League spends most of the comic trying to figure out how to rule over the people and prepare them for an oncoming war, and Wonder Woman spends most of the issue trying to tell Batman a morality tale that he doesn't want to listen to.
That magically lines up verbatim to what the Justice League was doing, which was just like, come on. I know that was the point, was that it was this parable to show what was wrong with what Justice League was doing, but it was also like it's just too convenient. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know they're both fictional stories that the writer is using, but like that's just too convenient for me personally.
Yeah. This story, I don't know. This issue didn't do it for me. I'm not really interested in this story. Superman accepting to rule over the people didn't feel like his character. And I still think some of the Justice League characters are not doing what they normally do.
No, and I have to agree with you. I'm frustrated because I find the potential of this story very intriguing. And we've seen some stories, similar stories like this, where the Justice League does become like corrupted rulers, like the Justice Lords from the animated series. But this just wasn't doing – this feels like somebody wanting to write a thesis on why Wonder Woman is better than the rest of the entirety of DC. Like, I don't know how else to put it. Like, it's literally just like we read 20 pages of Wonder Woman basically telling them I told you so, which I don't want to read that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just sort of like I'm right because you did this wrong, and I'm right because you did this wrong, and I'm right because you did this wrong. And it was like, well, you could have stepped in at any point. You know, it's sort of like you're rubbing it in, but you aren't doing anything to make the situation better yourself.
No. And we know Wonder Woman as a character well enough to know if she didn't like something, she'd step in and stop Clark.
Right. Well, and also, like, are you really going to tell me that Wonder Woman is the only person with a brain on the Justice League? Like, everybody else is just – Barry is clearly – as is usual, for whatever reason, a bumbling idiot, which is just an ongoing frustration with the portrayal of his character. So he clearly isn't capable of doing anything intelligent. And then Batman is just sitting there basically twiddling his thumbs going, burr, 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 I don't know what to do. Like, seriously? Nobody else is even trying. That's my frustration with this story, is that it's basically contingent on you believing that Wonder Woman, who is very capable, I understand, but is the only competent member of the Justice League?
The other problem I had with this story is, how long is this taking place for? Because we've had the Justice League off Earth for, I mean, it seemed like it was days or weeks or, I don't know, it seemed like a long time. You're going to tell me the Justice League is going to stay out there for that long messing with this planet when Earth is unprotected now?
I agree with you there, but the other thing was, I think only like several days had passed, but the events seemed like it should have been weeks.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure it was like 4 days, which that's too, I'm sorry, but that's too fast. Like, a revolution you don't go through all the steps that they go through in 4 days. I know it's a fictional world and a fictional story, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I know what you mean.
That's way too accelerated of a timeline, because I agree with you. It seems like they're there for a long time, but I'm fairly certain, according to the comic, all of that issue took place within 4 days.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm not too thrilled about this story, but we'll see what happens next issue. All right. Let's move on to our next title for this week, Nightwing number 72. So in this episode, we see Bea Bennett, Rick Grayson's girlfriend, has come to Gotham seeking bat help. Barbara Gordon answers her makeshift bat signal, and Bea explains to Barbara what has been going on with Rick and the visit he got with the Joker. After Rick defeated the Joker, we see how strange his behavior is. After her talk with Bea, Batgirl goes in search of Rick Grayson and finds him on one of the Gotham rooftops. She tries to give him his old Nightwing costume, but he refuses. Punchline shows up and starts battling Batgirl. Punchline cuts Batgirl with a knife, and then when Nightwing steps in and stops Punchline, Nightwing states that he had a deal, and Punchline apologizes while painting on a smiley face on his lips with Barbara's blood. Then Nightwing attacks Batgirl, knocking her unconscious. The Joker shows up and makes a lame joke about Bruce taking a family picture with his bat phone with his new family. And it's obvious that the Joker has used the crystal to brainwash Dick into becoming part of his family.
So knowing what we know about Batgirl's story ending, I'm a little bit concerned that the editorial team is considering fridging her again in some way. And I cannot describe how horrible a decision that would be.
Yeah, it does look like they're going to do something, doesn't it?
I would love to be wrong about this. I would love to, and I might be. We don't really have any hardcore proof of this other than we know the title's ending. But, like, man, that would be a bad choice for, I think, a number of reasons. People might disagree with that, and that's fine, but, like, wrong. It's the wrong, in my opinion, it's the wrong choice.
Let's hope they do not do that.
Yeah.
Me, I'm hoping, I guess I've been hoping this for a long time. I'd like to have a Dick and Barbara relationship. And it's always been off again, on again, where it's never been long term. But I'd like to finally see it for once.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think a lot of people would like, a lot of writers seem to want to see it too, if I'm being honest, Drew. I'm not so sure that that's a creator thing. I'm fairly certain that's an editorial DC thing that has prevented that from happening.
Yeah, you're probably right on that.
There has been, I can think of at least two separate runs of either Nightwing or Batgirl where they seem to be wanting to build towards something with that. And in none of those cases did something come from it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
I don't know either. So, I'm just hoping they get... Obviously, they're going to be playing around with Dick being on Joker's team for a while. But I'm expecting him to get back to his regular status quo by the end of this Joker War story.
Really making the situation worse before they make it better, though.
Yes. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Strange Adventures number 3. So, the issue opens up with Mr. Terrific leaving Adam Strange's place after the interview. And I'm kind of disappointed we didn't get to see any of the interview, though we did learn that Mr. Terrific asked questions about their daughter, and the couple was not happy about that. Throughout the issue, we see Adam Strange talking with Superman and Hawkman, trying to learn more about the investigation. And Adam learns from Hawkman that Mr. Terrific was asking a lot of questions about their daughter. We also see Adam and Elena talking with a lawyer, looking at their options. Later on, we see the couple giving an interview on television and talking about Mr. Terrific's investigation interfering with Adam's mission to keep Earth from being invaded by the Pict. Now, on Ran, we see in the flashback that Adam is fighting Kalint Harar of the Helotate in some sort of ceremonial battle to the death. And if Adam wins, the Helotate will aid him in the war. But the comics seem to indicate if Kalint wins, he was going to be taking Adam's wife. And even though Adam gets cut by a poisonous blade during the battle, Adam wins by using his helmet to cut off Kalint's head. Yeah, that was brutal. Now, at the end of the issue, Batman goes to Elena and asks her what her game is about, the evasion tactic from their television interview. And then we see a picture of Batman's encounter ends up on the news.
I feel like the comic's really starting to get interesting here, right? I'm a huge fan of the first two issues, but you know, this is like, it feels like he's starting to kind of like get into it. We had seen a little bit of a crack in the veneer last time when he killed that animal. But then this one, this is the first time usually we've seen in the flashbacks, you've got Doc Shaner's art, right? So it looks kind of nicer, a more idealized version. And then you get that just brutal scene where he kills his opponent. I mean, that is vicious.
Yeah, that was.
It is portrayed is perfect. I mean, they really like the way they like zoom in on his crazy eyes.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. That is some really good artwork and storytelling. This issue does not paint Elena in a very protagonist light, let's say. Kind of seems like maybe she's the one that's up to something, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And it might be both, but maybe it's like, I'm almost wondering, at least it feels like King wants us to be thinking like maybe Adam Strange isn't, like he's okay, but maybe he's unaware of something that Elaine is up to also. I don't know. It doesn't feel, to me, it didn't feel like the pseudo Fox News plot thing was his idea. That seemed like an entirely her idea thing.
Yeah, and I think that's why Batman went and confronted her, because it felt like that to him too.
Yeah. So this series is so good. I know we're only 3 issues in, but I am wildly intrigued to see where this story goes.
The other thing I wanted to point out about Elena is I don't ever remember seeing her smoke cigarettes before this series. And, that kind of gives her a more, I don't want to say evil tint, maybe. I don't know.
It sticks out now, right? I think that's something I feel like we probably wouldn't have noticed if this had been a couple decades earlier. But now in like 2020, that definitely, it's something that sticks out. It's not really something you see.
Yeah. So this was a really interesting issue. I would love to see what questions Mr. Terrific was asking. I have a feeling they might reveal some of that later in the series, but for now, we know he's asking about his daughter. And one thing we're not getting is what Mr. Terrific is thinking. And
We know he thinks the daughter isn't actually dead.
Right, but we don't know any more about what he's thinking. So they're leaving that as a mystery for now. So, which I'm sure we're going to see unfold as the series goes.
Man, but, I can't wait. I can't tell you how hooked on this mystery I am.
It's really good. Tom King does it again.
Yeah, seriously.
All right. Well, let's move on to our last title for this week. Jimmy Olsen, number 12. And it's the last issue of Jimmy Olsen. The issue opens up with Perry White announcing the Daily Planet will be closing forever. We see Detective Jim Corrigan, no, the other one, goes to arrest Julian Olsen for the attempted murder of his brother, Jimmy Olsen. Julian is not in the mansion, but he leaves clues for Jimmy and Janie. And a race to the airport in a car and a UFO finds Julian at the airport about to take off. I can never pronounce this guy's name. Porcilio hits Julian with his croc and tackles him. Yeah, I found that hilarious.
Tackles him through the airplane.
I know.
Which is just absurd.
So we see Julian goes to jail. Now, when Jimmy and Janie are trying to figure out what to do because they are broke, Miss Tessmacher shows up with evidence showing that the Olsons and the Luthers are related. As a blood relative, Jimmy and Janie have access to the Luther Trust. Now, we see Jimmy confronts Lex about funding all of Janie's plays and then funding the Daily Planet forever. Lex laughs at Jimmy, confesses he was behind everything except the murder attempt, and we see Jimmy catches everything on camera. So, at the end of the issue, we see that Jimmy is now the new publisher of the Daily Planet, and the issue ends with Jimmy getting a new signal watch from Superman. I love the wrap-up to this series. I thought it was pretty good. And it also changes the status quo, because I'm guessing it felt like the status quo is going to be changing in the regular title, too. At least that's what it felt like to me.
Which, honestly, I'm not going to lie to you, was really surprising to me, because I really didn't think this story was going to have any bearing on continuity. Considering how absurd and ridiculous it was, I just assumed it was its own thing. And then, like, I agree with you. I think at the end it was potentially establishing a new status quo for the Daily Planet. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. I'm a little bit surprised.
I was very surprised, too. And I'm kind of happy about it. Something as ridiculous as this series having an impact on the regular titles. So I'm glad they worked that in like that.
I am curious if it really is, though, or if it's like nominally connected to like the current status quo of Superman, but then Bendis is just going to keep telling his story anyway.
You never know.
I can't lie. I'm kind of curious to see what the stat, like going forward in the Superman books, which is where we'll mainly see this, if there is any change there. I almost would be a little bit surprised because it kind of seemed like he was still doing his
that could
Daily
be
Planet story.
The only way we'll know is when we go back to the other titles in it, if anything's changed. Yeah. And who knows, maybe this was Bendis' idea, so it's possible.
It's possible.
I know you're gonna be negative about it, and I'm gonna be optimistic about it.
Only reason I'd be surprised if it was his idea is if it was his idea, why hasn't it popped up in his book? At least the idea, the tease of something like that. We haven't even seen Jimmy, really.
No, we haven't. But we'll see what happens.
I have a hard time believing. I still can't believe that this is in continuity. I really thought that they basically just gave Matt Fraction that carte blanche to just tell a story. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk our DC television shows.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
And I'm Tony Heath.
And we've been watching Doctor Who for 5 years.
So that makes us experts.
Probably.
I once heard a guy say that he listened to a 4-hour podcast by an expert, which made him an expert.
So we're experts.
Definitely experts.
And you can be an expert, too.
All you have to do is listen to
The Watchathon of Rassilon.
It's a podcast
that we make
together.
Sometimes with friends.
Listen to it.
Or else.
The Watchathon of Rassilon.
A proud member of the ESO Network.
And we're back. Let's talk Stargirl, Season 1, Episode 8, Shiv Part 2. The episode opens up with Pat ramming his beloved car into a light pole. We find out that Pat uses the accident as a cover story for Courtney's injuries from her battle with Shiv. Now, Pat wants to come clean to Barbara, but Courtney begs Pat to wait until after they have stopped the Injustice Society and that Blue Valley is safe. Courtney says that if they tell her mom the truth, she won't let Courtney be Stargirl anymore. Now, at home, Courtney rests in bed while Mike brings Courtney some snacks. He apologizes for what he said at the homecoming game and how Pat is his dad and not hers. And he explains he's not used to having to share his dad with anyone, but he thinks it's pretty cool Courtney is his sister. And while I'm watching the scene, I kept wondering when he's going to end up borrowing that pin.
Didn't that scene feel unearned? Like they've not interacted.
No, they haven't.
The only interaction they've had is the negative one. So I was like, what? I mean, sure, if you guys had at least one moment before that where you guys had some sort of bonding time, but you haven't. They've had literally, I cannot think of a single bonding moment those two have had.
I know. It was kind of out of left field, but I'm just going to let it go.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes sense, right? Like, that's the logical sort of scene that you have right there. It's just, they, like, didn't do the work beforehand to make that scene work.
Agreed. Of course, it could have ended up on the chopping block, too.
Yeah, well, yes, that's a good point. I'm not going to lie. I did not put the pieces together initially when Pat rammed his car into the pole. I was like, what the hell?
I know. I did the same thing. I was like, what is he doing?
I was like, was this some flashback to like his reckless days following the death of Starman? Like, what are we seeing here? And then only after that, I was like, oh, that's 100% logical. I totally get what you did. But I was not on the same page.
I wasn't either.
It was a good, like, it was smart. I have to admit, I was like, oh, yeah, well done. I really like that the show did a good job trying to build in a reasonable explanation for her injuries, right? Because I feel like sometimes you have scenes, you know, in other shows where a hero gets severely injured and they just sort of never address the fact that there would be no good explanation for why their civilian a persona would have an injury like that.
Yeah. They can't fall down the stairs again.
Right, right. No, so I like that they put in the effort to show that. God, the Pat thing is going to blow up with his wife. That is not going to end well.
No, it's not. Now we see Beth, Yolanda, and Rick go to Cindy's house in order to find out her connection to the Injustice Society. When Pat comes along, he gets stuck going into Cindy's with Beth. And with Pat distracting Cindy's stepmother, Beth is able to locate the secret tunnel beneath the house. Frightened by Solomon Grundy, though, Beth dashes back into the house and goes to Cindy's room, where she discovers that her father is Dr. Ido. Now, back at her house, Courtney is bored until Cindy shows up to see how she's doing after the accident and apologize to Courtney and how she treated her at the football game. And when Cindy goes to leave, she tells Courtney that she knows she is Stargirl and she'll keep her secret for now, but she'll be back after she kills her friends. Now, when Cindy showed up at Courtney's, I knew right away. I was like, oh, she knows her secret identity. Is that what you thought too?
Oh, yeah.
Because it was weird.
I would have been honest. I frankly would have been frustrated if she hadn't known. Because the same thing, how could she not know at that point, right?
Right.
So, I don't know. I agree with you. I assumed that she knew, and I was honestly relieved when she did reveal it. Because I was like, okay, frankly, you should know. So...
So we see Courtney suits up and goes after Cindy. And when their battle goes out onto the street, we see Henry drives up and he steps out of the car and his powers start to manifest again. Not being able to control his abilities yet, Henry unleashes a powerful telekinetic wave that sends both Stargirl and Cindy flying. And Dr. Ido's goons show up and drag Cindy into the sewer. I thought this was a pretty good episode. And I had to laugh when Beth took Pat into Cindy's house, and he's just wanting to get the heck out of there. And Beth is like, no, I want to explore things. And then he has to deal with the stepmother, ends up trying to fix her sink. She starts flirting with him. I just found it hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I am enjoying the show. The more it goes on, and the more they're able to develop some of the characters and stuff. Like, I really am intrigued by Icicle as a character. He's such an interesting villain to me. And then, the way they continue to develop the rest of the team dynamic and the way they kind of play off each other. It feels like a group of teenagers who are not ready to be superheroes. Like, I feel like the show really captures that idea really well, that they don't just have them throw on costumes and be immediately competent. Like, it really does feel like they are out of their depth, which they are. I don't know. So I enjoy the way the show is progressing quite a bit.
I am too. All right, let's move on to our last episode for this week. Doom Patrol, Season 2, Episode 4, Sex Patrol. But before we get into this episode, we got to let you know, we've got a visitor here in the Earth Station DCU office. They've let him out of the airlock. Let's welcome Bobby Nash.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. It's so nice to get out of the airlock every so often. Stretch the old, arms and legs.
We won't tell Faber we let you out.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah, they... I feel like the man in the iron mask sometimes, hidden away back there, you know?
All right. Well, when this episode opens up, we have a flashback to London, England, 1978. Niles is having a tea party with Dorothy, but it is time for him to go. Niles leaves Dorothy with Danny, and she is very sad. So we see this episode explores the idea that Danny was her prison, not her sanctuary. Now, in the present, Danny the Brick is broken, as we saw Dorothy drop him during a game of hide-and-seek last episode. As Niles tries to comfort her, Doom Manor gets some visitors. Flex Mentallo, Mara Lee Corrupt, and the Dannyzens show up to throw a party to help fix Danny. This episode focuses on Dorothy clearly wanting to become an adult. And even though she is stuck in the body of an 11-year-old, Dorothy is actually near 175 years old. We see Dorothy connect with Flex Mentallo when he floats her up to hang the disco ball. We see that Rita shows her how to use makeup to enhance her beauty. And when the party needs to be kicked up a notch, Dorothy sings Pure Imagination from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with a very beautiful voice. I love that scene. Now, one thing we get into in this episode is the bedtime framing device. Most of the times when we got a new bedtime, we'd also get a new version of Jane. Not every time, but a lot of the times. Each trying to leave the manor, but getting sidetracked by what is going on in the real world. Now, the different versions we see in this episode include Hammerhead, Scarlet, Harlot, and Dr. Harrison. And by the end of the episode, we see Jane again as the primary. We also see Cyborg has returned to Doom Manor and is down in the dumps after getting stood up last episode. Cyborg gets some love advice from Morally Corrupt and to give love a second chance. We also see in this episode that Larry realizes that he might not be able to be intimate again because of his condition. We see one of the male Danizens dance with him, and Larry tells him that if he were to remove his bandages, he'd kill the guy and everybody at the party, which is not exactly flirty talk, but it's Larry's truth, and he needs to process that. So we kind of get the question, is there a possibility for him to be with someone again? We also see in this episode that Rita is jealous of Flex Mantello's ability to control his powers. And when she asks him about it, Flex states that a clear mind is the key to controlling his powers. And Rita admits that the only time she's been able to clear her mind was during the orgasm she had on Danny Street last season. So she asks Flex to do it again, but this time only contained it to the bedroom. Flex states that with great muscles comes great responsibility. Now, with Flex Mantello's nose turned towards the wall, Rita's orgasmic venture digs up repressed memories of her mother sleeping with a producer to land her a role. And on top of that, the sexual energy being produced draws out a sex demon complete with sex ghosts. Next, we see Danny's party crashed by the sex men, who explain that if they don't contain the demon before it gives birth to a baby, it cries will erase all the children from existence. And we see Hammerhead saves the day by grabbing the baby and shoving it back up the demon. We see that after his trip to Florida, Cliff is not in a good place. And when the chief offers him ecstasy, Cliff takes it. And at the end of the episode, we get one of my favorite lines from Doom Patrol. Is anyone going to say anything about Rita's G-spot almost ending the effing world? We find out that Danny is not going to be a street anymore, but a tire. So we get to see the great Bobby Nash in the background, nodding his head in agreement as Dorothy reads the note from Danny. And we end the episode with Dorothy asking Rita if she truly thinks she's beautiful. And we see Rita reply with what her mother told her. Darling, please, if you have other talents, focus on those. And it's the absolute wrong thing for Dorothy to hear. And it's followed up by the candlemaker telling her just to talk to her little girlfriends about it. Great episode of Doom Patrol. Probably one of my favorites.
I got to say, Bobby, I can't tell you how excited I was when we got to see you rocking your yellow hat in the background there.
Oh, yes. Man, they dolled me up nice. Yes, all of the clothes, everything I'm wearing is all theirs. I got a call to come in. What they were trying to do was, I guess this is a good skill to have. They were looking for unique faces and body types to populate the party. Cause I'm there from the knocking on the door through the party. I'm there for all of it. But you really only you get glimpses of me, but for the most part, you see me mostly there at the end. But they were like, we needed some unique, and I had a full beard at the time. I had grown the beard for another role, and so I still had the beard, and so they loved they thought the beard, and they needed a couple. You know, they were looking for some overweight people, and you know, I fit that bill as well. And they dolled me up really good. I don't know if the the ladies in wardrobe did it on purpose or not, but they definitely stuck me in a George R.R. Martin-ish looking cap, and so that was going around a lot. Robot Man kept referring to me as Disco George through the shoot. I became Disco George. I mean, that was, I wasn't there 20 minutes and that was, it's Disco George. So, but I was there. I worked 3 days. I was supposed to work six. I was supposed to get the 3 days I was there were the 3 days before Christmas, 3 days before Christmas Eve. Cause they were, when we shut down on that last day, everybody was taking off for Christmas break. And then we were supposed to go back in January, but I got sick, and I was so sick I couldn't go back. So that's why I'm in the parts, like when they go through that door after Dorothy sings, and it's into like the bar. I'm not in the bar scenes because those were filmed in January. And P.S. two different locations in two different cities. yes, the Doom Patrol, the manor, Doom Manor, is an actual mansion that we film in. It's an old rundown mansion, but beautiful. Like that's that parlor where the party is held is one of the, it's just absolutely a gorgeous location. A lot of carvings in the walls and just a lot to look at when you're not filming. And, but it was a lot of fun. The set was great. The director, I'm totally blanking on his name, I forgive me, was very good. He kept us, not only did we, a lot of times when you work, you don't know what's going on when you're in it, when you're in the background. They're just like, do this and you do that and you have no clue what's going on. And he was pretty good about telling us, here's what's happening. Here's what the scene is. Here's why you're doing what you're doing. And so that was good because we could actually put a little into it because we knew why we were doing what we were doing. Great crew, great set, a lot of fun. It was very, very lighthearted, you know, and I was there. Like I said, I got to watch quite a bit of stuff. You guys mentioned the Flex and Dorothy chemistry and relationship. I got to watch them do that because when she, I'm off to Flex's left a little bit when he does that with the, where he lifts her up in the air, and watching those two actors work on, even on set, the chemistry was perfect. I thought they were great together, and you know, watching them work the effect to make her fly and all of that was a lot of fun to watch. And she's fantastic. The girl playing Dorothy is just absolutely fantastic. And she does sing that song in front of all of us on the spot.
I was wondering that. I was very curious if it was actually her singing, because it seemed like it was when I was watching. It didn't look like it was lip syncing.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if they did something to it after. It didn't seem like it to me, because like I said, I watched her sing it several times. You know, because when you know how TV, in any filming works, you shoot these scenes multiple times.
Right.
She got up there and she's doing all the singing, and there was a piano playing. I from where I was at, I can't tell you if Timothy Dalton was playing the piano or not. He may have been. I don't know. But yeah, all that was done right there. It was done on the set, surrounded. There were maybe 100 people in that room. And but it's fun. We had a blast. It was so cold. It's very cold. But we were also dolled up and dressed up and multiple layers and all this, that it after a while it didn't feel too cold. And but yeah, so like the stuff when we're outside, I felt bad for the actor playing Flex. Like we're outside and we knock on the door. Well, that's like in December outside. It was maybe 30, 40 degrees.
Jeez.
And we were out there for a while, but the sun was out. I mean, it's Georgia. It wasn't like below zero or anything. So, but we do get cold snaps, I believe because we worked long, really long days too, because they had to get everything in before break. And it was like 2-3 in the morning when I would leave every night. And it would be around 28-30 degrees when we'd leave. So yeah, so very cold, but lots of great people. I met a lot of cool people that were there as extras. You know, they had a lot of eclectic, as you can see in the show, there's a lot of eclectic looks and people there. And we had a ball. It was just absolutely fun.
Out of curiosity, do you guys interact much with the main characters, or are you really just kind of told to do your own thing?
The way it generally works, and this is pretty much all sets, don't bother the actors. Don't treat it like a convention. You know, you're not getting selfies. You're not getting autographs.
Right.
Don't talk to the actors unless the actors talk to you. That's generally the rule of being a background actor. And in a lot of cases, the actors don't converse with the extras. There are cases where they do, Jane and Rita. I'm blanking on the name. April and, oh, I forget the other girl's name. They didn't really interact with us too much. They were there, did their thing, and then then they left. You know, when they weren't working, they were off the set a good bit. The guys playing Robot Man and Negative Man were there all the time. And since I was next to them for all the stuff with the tire, I was with them a good bit. So we chatted quite a bit. And now I'm assuming most people know this, but that is not Brendan Fraser and Matt Bomer in the costumes.
Right. That's what I thought. I was pretty sure that was the case.
Right. They provide the voices and then they play them in flashbacks before they're in costume. But that's not them in the costumes, you know, when their faces are covered. But the guys are great. I got to hanging out with them. I got to really look at their costumes. The Robot Man costume is incredible. It is very detailed. And I give him a lot of credit because it's hard for him to move. It's a big suit. And so they sit him down after every take. They bring a box and he sits on the box. But they have to take the faceplate off because that faceplate is full of electronics and flashing lights that are flashing right in his face to show through like Robot Man's eyes and all that. So it gets very hot in there. So they've made it removable so they can pop the faceplate off. And then Negative Man as well is one piece and can come off. And they're beautiful, but they're beautifully, beautiful costumes. And those two guys were great. Like I said, I talked to them quite a bit. And it doesn't really come through in the final episode, but like when we're there and I go in, you know, you see me touch the tire, I'm kind of between the two of them. And like, you know, Negative Man's patting me on the back and all this stuff, you know. So there was a lot of stuff we did just because we were all together all the time.
That's cool.
And yeah, so, Flex, briefly, because he was with us, Flex really didn't leave when, you know, he wasn't doing stuff. He kind of hung with us. He didn't put on a robe. I imagine he was probably chilly through the whole thing. But he would hang around and he spoke. You know, ever so often, I did get to speak very, very briefly to Timothy Dalton, which was very cool. He walked up and said hello, and that was cool. So I got to, you know, it's my first Bond I've ever met. That was really cool. but watching these, you know, and it's one of the things that I enjoy about doing what I do with these things is I love watching people work. Not just the actors, but I love watching how the crew works and what they do. And it's fascinating to me going, especially a TV shoot, because TV shoots move so much faster. With a movie shoot, they may yell cut and it's an hour before you do anything else. On a TV shoot, you yell cut, you're working again in 5 minutes, probably, unless there's a major change. Cause it's quick. You know, you have to get more done faster. So I love watching everyone work and seeing how they do what they do and why they do what they do. And I'm, you know, because when I see the episodes, no matter what I'm in, it looks off to me. And I don't mean that in a bad way, because my experience of being in this episode of Doom Patrol is from my vantage point, my point of view. I'm looking at everything in this direction. Well, the camera is looking at everything in totally opposite direction because they're looking at us. So when I see it on TV, I remember all this going on, but it looks weird to me because I was seeing it from a different angle. And so the things that I thought was important from my vantage point may not have been, may not show up on the screen. So it's a very interesting thing to watch an episode that you're in and then see how they, you know, cause you don't know, you see the cameras, but you don't know how they're going to cut it and all that stuff. So seeing it on the TV and then remembering how it was, it's fascinating to me.
They really focused in on you on that tire scene several times. I was surprised.
Yeah, I was, as I was watching the episode, I was a little nervous because sometimes when you do these things, and this has happened to me a lot, you go, oh, there's my elbow. Oh, there's my hat. Oh man, I'm behind that guy. You know, and so at the beginning of the party, like when the door opens and they're outside, you only see my hat because I'm standing near the back of the crowd because I was taller than, I was one of the taller people, so they put us in the back. So you can see my hat, but that's pretty much it. You can't see me. And then in all the stuff where Rita's trying to hang the ball and Flex is doing the bits with making the decorations happen, I'm all in that, but I'm like, oh, I'm standing behind Flex. You can't see anything but my elbow. Oh, I'm behind the flag that guy's holding. Oh, I'm over here at this point playing chess. You can see the guy I'm playing chess with, but Robot Man's blocking me. So you can't. And so I'm like, oh crap, I'm going to be in this whole episode. You're never going to see me. And so, but yeah, at the stuff with the tire, and it was really just luck of the draw. They were just like, they didn't position us. They didn't say, you're going to stand here. They're just like, we're in the scene, and the scene, they go, okay, at this point, we want you guys to just, when this happens, start walking toward the tire, get there, put, you know, if you're close and you can reach it, put your hands on it. And I just happened to be in a position that when I got there, I was right there at the tire. And so, yeah, so that was cool. So all those of us who had our hands on the tire, every time after that first time, we had to be there so it would match up. But yeah, but that was fun. That was work. And that was a good, and you know, being part of the special effect of it as well. It's you know, because we all vanish, and you know, spoiler alert, I guess, the fireworks go off and we all vanish with Danny, and we've gone traveling the universe with Danny. And the way the special effect works is we all reach in and touch the tire, and we're told what's going to happen, but we obviously don't see the fireworks and all this when we're filming it. We know it's going to happen. And then they basically yelled, okay, everybody freeze. And so all of us stop and they say, okay, Danny's get out. And we all leave. And then everybody that doesn't leave, the Doom Patrol guys all stay stock still. And when we leave, they can pull back the camera and we're just gone. And so it's a simple little trick, but it works.
That's cool.
That is cool.
So, but yeah, but it was fun. I had a blast. This is my second appearance, but my first one was really very short. But I had a blast. The people were great. There was one scene that I was sad you don't see. I can tell it's still there, but I'm hidden behind Flex and the guy with the flag. When Flex is doing the bits to decorate, I'm off in that corner. Like Flex is there, I'm off to his left in that corner. And you can barely see me in a couple of where I've got like a red thing around my neck. And so the way we were shooting it, I'm in that corner and there are these three drag queens are trying to convince me that I need to wear the red feather boa. And I don't want to wear the red feather boa. And so they're convincing me. And so they finally convince me to wear it. And just as I throw it around my neck, you know, Flex is doing his bit and we're all like, ooh, wow, ooh, wow, you know? And so as lights and she makes it where she says, and flowers, and he flexes and flowers pop up. There's a table with flowers behind me that is, I'm supposed to go like they've popped in. And so they startle me. And so I kind of do this leap thing where it's and turn and look and there's flowers. And that part's not in there. I can tell it's there, but you can't really see me because I'm behind Flex on the camera. But that's when I get getting to do the interactions with the flowers, and I knocked the table over twice. that may be why they didn't use it. I don't know. Yeah, but again, I knocked the poor flower, the poor table with flowers over twice. So it was a ton of fun. I had a blast. Wish I could have gone back the other 3 days to been in more, you know, because I would have been in the party scene where they go through the door. And then FYI, yeah, like I mentioned before, when she goes through that door, the double door singing and we're following, that goes to a completely different set in a different place. Because when you go through that door, it's a storeroom. You know, just like when she goes to answer the door and she's walking to the front door, off to the left, you see the elevator doors. Well, there's not an elevator there. We go through that door and down a set of stairs into the ballroom. So that's where the ballroom is. So there's a lot of little trickery stuff like that that makes to make the mansion look a little more modern in some places.
Just real quick, I was glad that you mentioned the actress that plays Dorothy. I thought she's been so good on the show so far this season. I'm just curious because I don't know if either you guys know. Is she playing the young version of Rita in the scene that we see in this episode? Because I knew they were clearly trying to draw parallels between Rita's interaction with her mom and then the interactions between her and Dorothy. It looked like the same girl, but I couldn't tell.
You know, I'm not sure.
And I couldn't tell either. So I didn't even think about her being her. That would make sense instead of casting somebody else, because we always see her in the makeup. So
Right. And oh, and that makeup is flawless too. I mean, up in person, because you don't see it. It's not in the episode where with me, but you see her when she's going around delivering like cookies and things in the party with the makeup on.
Right
before Niles tells her she needs to get rid of the lipstick. You know, she's walking around to us and like holding up the plate of goodies, and we're taking donuts and brownies and whatever's off of it. And yeah, the makeup is absolutely fantastic on her. And through all of them, I mean, there's a lot of great, the people that work on this do fantastic work with how making these guys look the part, you know. And like I said, the Robot Man and Negative Man costumes are just exquisite. And so kudos to everyone that worked on it. And I know for this particular scene, they had a lot of makeup people on hand, because not only were we all dressed in our funky best clothes that they could put us in, we're all covered in face paint, and it's a little hard to see under the hat because the hat they had me in kind of shades my face, but they had put black paint on my eyebrows and then took the black paint all the way up into my hairline. So it kind of gives me a V shape almost look on my face. So, and then I'm wearing like gold paint all over my face, and they glued like jewels to my face. And so they don't all, some of that's kind of hard to see in the shots that, you know, the screen grabs I took, so they had us all nice and painted and colored. And some people had glitter, some had, some people had really fancy costumes. There were quite a few people there that were basically wearing shorts, shoes, and body paint. So yeah, there were some people that, you know, got a lot more makeup than I did. But it was definitely an eclectic bunch. And it was really cool. I mean, seeing everybody together was really, really fun. It was very festive, like a Mardi Gras almost type feel. So they did a good job on keeping all of us, you know. I had taken a photo with my camera just to remember what it looked like, and then I somehow deleted it before I could get it off my camera. But yeah, it was good. It was good makeup. It was they did a really good job. So. And I've gotten asked this a lot, so I don't know if we're coming back or not. because I've been asked several times, you know, are you guys going to, we're going to see the Dannysons again? And I honestly have no idea. Where they don't, they, yeah, at my level, we don't know that. That's, you know.
I'd be surprised if we didn't see them again at some point. It's just too good of a reoccurring character, set of characters.
Yeah. I don't know. I agree. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, and the Danny thing is really interesting, too, because they've really created this fully three-dimensional feeling character, you know, out of something that's not there. Yeah. It's all, you know, just off of the reactions of other people. And, you know, that was one of the things when we were, you know, this is Danny, we were told it's a tire, but to you, it's not a tire. It's a living thing. Danny is, you know, Danny is alive. And that's, you know, I'm pretty sure others did as well, but that's how I played it. This is not a tire. You know, this is something that means a lot to me. This is a character that saved our lives, because, you know, the whole concept of Danny the Street is Danny's taking in the outcasts, the people that are not wanted by society or are hunted by society, or, you know, people that need help that aren't getting it from society. Danny is there for them. So I also love in this story, too, that some of those people are now there for Danny because Danny needs the help. So it becomes this very symbiotic relationship between Danny and the Dannysons, which is what they call us, the Dannysons. And so the fact that we all go off on this journey with her or him, I'm not sure if Danny's a him or a her, but as we go off on this journey to wherever with Danny, yeah, I would be, it's too good a character that we won't see Danny again. Well, whether you see all of us is another story, but because I was not in Danny's Street in season one, so it is kind of, there is a little fluidity there of how that works.
All right, well, let's talk about this episode overall. Me, I really like this episode a lot. Dorothy, I think this is moving Dorothy's story along. This episode did a good job of moving Dorothy's story along and had a lot of funny moments in it. And I did love the singing part with Pure Imagination. That was great.
I had also, I can't believe I had forgotten about it, but I had forgotten the orgasm scene from season one. And then when Rita was asking Flex to do it again, I was like, oh yeah. And then I had to obviously, like, after the episode ended, I had to like go and pull up that scene to rewatch it again, because it's such a masterpiece.
I gotta tell you, I watched this episode twice.
I love the relationships in this episode, especially. I love, and there's multiples of them, you know, certainly Flex and Dorothy, or Flex or Dorothy and the Chief, you know, when she's convincing, how are you going to help? And she's like, you know, she shows him the sheet music, and you kind of see the Chief soften a little because he smiles, and there's a good memory that comes with singing this song with her. And, you know, the relationships between Negative Man and Cyborg there a little at the end, there's, you know, some there, and obviously, you know, Flex and Rita have a great relationship in this episode. You know, there's all kinds of really good things, the character bits when these characters get together. And what's her name again that knocks on the door with Flex? I'm blanking on the name, the character's name.
Which, like, character?
When they open the door and Negative Man comes out, and she goes, Larry Traina. I'm blanking on her name.
Morally corrupt.
Thank you. I don't know why that's hard to remember. Those two have a fantastic relationship in seeing them together. And obviously, I remember they were together in season one. But that scene, in filming that scene and watching those two them shoot that, where this is the first time they've seen each other in a while, and when he opens the door, and she goes, Larry Traina, and then he, you know, And so, and then seeing their look on his face too. And because at that point, you know, because it wasn't on him, he wasn't wearing the mask. The actor was just doing this thing. But there was a lot of fun there. And so I loved those character interactions of seeing the characters do things together. Robot Man and Jane, and somebody's getting a hug, or, you know, it's obviously the flying scene with Dorothy probably tops the episode for me, though. That was beautiful.
Dorothy got a lot of moments like that in this episode.
Yeah.
So
I found the parallel they were drawing between her and Rita was interesting, because that feels like a theme that we're going to continue to see at least in a couple more episodes, I would say. I'm intrigued to see where that goes.
I have this, and I have no basis on this other than in my head. So this is not a speaker. I have a feeling Dorothy's going to be in some way instrumental in Rita learning how to use her power.
Yeah.
Because of what we saw in this episode and the parallels, I just have a feeling that's going to come into play down the road.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm still wondering what the Candlemaker's, what his goal is.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Well, it's interesting because we know all of these are in some way, some aspect of Dorothy. And so it's interesting in that, is it a separate character with ulterior motives, or is it really just a manifestation of the darker parts of Dorothy herself?
That's a good question.
Because we see she almost murders Danny in this episode. And yes, in theory, it's the Candlemaker driving her to do it. But is that really just, you know what I mean? Is that really just a manifestation of her own deep down frustrations with the situation she's been put in by her dad? You know what I mean? So And especially with the general themes of psychosis and stuff with this show, I don't know. I think it's a really good question, Drew, because I think it could go either way. I think it could ultimately be some creature that has somehow bound itself to her, or it really could just be essentially like the evil portion of Dorothy. And so whatever its motives are essentially Dorothy's own motives, which would probably ultimately just be freedom, right?
Yeah. Now, another question I have for you is, were you surprised to see Jane back in control? I was not expecting that to happen. I thought they were going to do something new or have a different personality take over. But it seems like they want Jane back in control for now, at least.
Yeah, I'm always just, I don't know what they're going to do. So I don't really go into Jane with many expectations of how it's, you know, because I'm never right. I never guess correctly. Yeah. I will say she plays it well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My guess would be is that we see in this episode, Drew, like you mentioned in your summary, that the different personalities keep trying to do their thing. And none of them can really do it when confronted with the real world, the outside world. They're all unable to handle it because they're used to, like, the painter, right?
Right.
All she does is paint, and she can't like any other responsibility she can't handle because that's not her job, so to speak. And so I think part of it's really subtle, but it almost is like the group collectively realizing, like, oh, that's why. Usually the show is a little bit more direct in making that point, but that would be my guess.
All right. Any last words on this episode?
It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed watching it, and, you know, it was, and from a personal experience, it was a great, you know, it's a great memory. It was a great set to work on. And, yeah, it's a cool show.
So are we going to start seeing you every season on Doom Patrol now?
Hey. I'm happy to take the work. You know, yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, like I said, I have no idea if you'll ever see any of us there again. Then again, the guy I played in season one was nothing like this guy. So, you know, it just depends on, you know, if they call me and say, hey, you want to come play? Sure. I know right now nothing is filming here at the moment. Everything is still on, you know, lockdown status and quarantine bits. I was working on another TV show. I went in and worked on a Thursday, and we were supposed to come back on Monday, and that weekend was when the quarantine went into effect. And so I haven't been back since. So, I kind of miss it. It's really weird. And I needed the beard too. I finally shaved off the beard after a while, but the thing I filmed last, I had to have the beard for. So if I ever go back, I'd have to grow it again or have a fake one or something. But, but yeah, after a while, the beard had to go.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah.
I'd never had one before. It's where, yeah, I'm 48 years old. I've never had a full beard in my life until last September, I guess. I grew it out for another role, not this one, for another role with the intention of shaving it off right after. But it was like, oh, this is nice. I've never had one before. So I'll keep it for a little bit. I said, I'll keep it till it gets annoying. And then I was like, I was getting ready to shave. Then the Doom Patrol thing came along. So I said, I'll keep it a little longer. Then the other thing, I was like, okay, now I'll shave. Oh, then this other acting gig came along and needed the beard. And so, yeah, I ended up keeping it longer than planned. But, yeah, eventually it was like, this has got to go.
All right. Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Bobby?
You know, you can find me at bobbynash.com. Swing by, check out. I'm all over social media. Come by, say hi. Let me know what you thought of the episode. Thanks so much for having me back. We need to do this more often.
We were both thrilled when we found out that you were going to be in this episode. We were so excited.
Yeah, when I do these, I'm always very nervous about, you know, I'm there, you know, because I've done movies and TV shows where it's like, I know I'm there, but I don't appear anywhere on the screen. And that's always a fear. And so, yeah, when suddenly there I am, big as life, I'm like, I like it.
That's awesome.
All right. What's your shout out this week, Cletus?
So I was just so fascinated by the whole sex men thing. It just seemed so ridiculous. I had to find what issue it came from. So if you're curious to see effectively the comic book version of this story, issue 48 of Doom Patrol, from, again, technically volume 2, issue 48 is the sex men issue, of course, by Grant Morrison, because who else, right?
All right, for my shout out, I'm going to shout out about Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. He had Tom Cavanaugh on recently, and Tom talks about how he thought he was only going to be on for the first season, and the show asking him to stay on and play Reverse Flash along with the other versions of Harrison Wells. So I found that all interesting.
That's cool. I'll definitely have to listen to that one.
Yeah. When I saw he was on there, I was like, ooh, I got to listen to this.
Yes, I love the fact that he's technically a different character every season. It's and he's fantastic.
Yeah, he's great.
It's got to be, I would imagine, for an actor, that's got to be an appealing thing to that role, right? Because it's not going to be stale. You're constantly doing something new.
Yeah. Plus, there was that time, you know, with all the different, like, him interacting with, like, five or six versions of Harrison Wells at one time. And, yeah, I imagine for him, it's got to be a lot of fun.
All right. If you'd like to leave us any comments, you can reach us on our feedback line at 317-564-9133. Leave us a message. Or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Action Comics, Batgirl, Batman, Detective Comics, Justice League Dark, Shazam, and, of course, Stargirl and Doom Patrol. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Yay!
Back in the airlock.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.